The Today Show's ratings dropped. The program was no longer lighthearted and cozy, so a lot of people simply stopped watching. It wasn't John's fault. He was the wrong guy in the wrong place in the wrong time slot, and he knew it. Years later, in an interview with Larry King, John, who would go on to anchor NBC Nightly News for 12 years, described his 14-month stint at Today as simply awful. I found myself introducing musical acts at 7:45 in the morning, and that was just too much for me. I, on the other hand, benefited mightily from John's uncomfortable tenure because of Shad, enlightened Shad. "I don't see what Barbara's doing just writing women's features," he said one day at a writer's meeting. "She's perfectly capable of writing any of the stories for the show." Did the world stop? Did anyone realize what was happening? No, but for the first time in the program's history, I, a female, was cleared to write stories about science and finance, even world news, as well as, of course, the tea-pouring features. As far as I know, there was no revolt from the show's viewers or any of the daily guests, and there didn't seem to be a serious protest from the other writers, although no one volunteered to write the tea-pouring stories with me. Even with all the extra work, I was very grateful. My day still began at 4 a.m., but the work was much more interesting. Once in the studio, I would meet with John Chancellor and go over the interviews I had prepared for him. Then I would meet with the guest who was to be interviewed and discuss the area of questions to make sure we were all on the same track. When the program was over at 9 a.m., we would have a post-mortem meeting to discuss what did or didn't go right. At 10 a.m., I would go to the food counter at the drugstore in the lobby of 30 Rock. As I had by then been up for 5 hours, I would have a BLT or perhaps a hamburger, followed by an order of chocolate ice cream. Then it was off to my nice office where I manned the phone, booked guests, wrote features and future interviews. There were meetings, conferences, private rages at the guests who canceled, and cheers if someone we really were trying to book came through. I rarely went to lunch, as I had already had my lunch at 10 a.m. About 6 p.m. I took a bus home, often stopping at the supermarket across the street from my apartment to buy bologna and a roll. Still my favorite dinner. If I wasn't going out, I was in bed by 9:30 p.m. It was all fine, and it got better. Shad was the first producer at NBC to put me on the air, at least in something other than a bathing suit. My mini debut in July 1961 was from a bicycle seat in Central Park. Shad's hope was to give a female slant to what was most often a very male-oriented broadcast, so I produced and introduced a piece for him about biking in Central Park. I couldn't drive, but I did know how to ride a bike. That appearance was followed the next month by a more substantial debut, covering the fall fashion collections in Paris. I couldn't believe my good fortune. I had suggested the feature to Shad, and there I was, being sent to Paris to cover the ever-so-chic couture fashion shows. What an assignment! I still have the grainy black-and-white film of my debut at the Today desk on August 29, 1961, and though it sounds so immodest to say it, I can see now why Shad put me on air. I still had the then-fashionable short-with-bangs Audrey Hepburn haircut, so I looked like almost every other young woman in the country, which meant they could relate to me. Most of all, I was funny. I was introduced by Frank Blair, who was doing light features for the program. I remember complaining with a wink, "Oh, Frank, it was awful. First of all, every day I had to go look at fashion shows. And then I had to have lunch at Maxime's and drink champagne. And then I had to smell all the perfumes at Dior. I mean, it was so trying that I took absolutely the last plane home." I loved doing my little segment on the air. But it never occurred to me that I would ever have a regular on-air role myself. Glamour, not humor, and certainly nothing intellectual, was the requirement if a woman wanted to be in front of the camera. All I wanted was to do whatever I was asked to do, so I wouldn't be replaced by some other female writer. I just wanted to keep my job. For the next 20 years, 30 years, maybe even 40, I would feel the same way. No matter how high my profile became, how many awards I received, or how much money I made, my fear was that it all could be taken away from me. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to link that insecurity to my father's roller coaster career, or to my mother's constant anxiety, or to my sister's needs. I have, as I've said, always felt I was auditioning, either for a new job or to make sure that I could hold on to the one I had. And that's not all bad. Though I've lived in varying degrees of anxiety throughout the course of my career, I've never really changed my attitude. I've worked as hard or harder than anyone else, accepted most every assignment, done my homework, kept complaints to myself, finished the job, and moved on. That is not a bad formula for success. To my relief, my family was stable during that first whirlwind year at Today. My parents and Jackie were settled in Las Vegas, where my father continued to produce his lavish shows and assemble the most gorgeous line of showgirls and dancers. Unlike in Miami or New York, in Vegas these beauties could leave their breasts exposed. The costumes, as usual, were exquisite, so were the breasts. The owners of the Tropicana, which up until then had mostly big-name stars as their headliners, were delighted with my father's work, particularly with his version of Paris's Folies Bergère. They gave him a contract, and more of the other hotels began to follow his formula, using big production numbers as the main attraction. My parents bought a small house in Vegas. My father even planted a rose garden. It wasn't Broadway, but it wasn't a low floor in a hospital either. Professionally, he was having a second wind. He was flying to New York, Miami, and Europe looking for acts and inspiration. The Tropicana's owner rode hard on my father's extravagant impulses, and they were paying him a nice salary. I myself was making pretty good money then, some $500 a week, and I continued to repay Lou Chesler. I never told my father about the loan. I thought it would humiliate him. Mr. Chesler often offered to forgive it, but I didn't want him to. He was there when I needed him, and this was my way of showing my gratitude. I was also relieved that Jackie seemed happy. As usual, she'd made friends with some of the chorus girls and soon found a brand new friend in one of my father's headliners, Carol Channing, the irrepressible Broadway star of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and later Hello, Dolly. Carol's father, George Channing, had been a serious follower of the Christian Science movement, and she had grown up with many Jackies around her family's house. She seemed to truly enjoy my sister's company. Carol invited Jackie to her every show, telephoned her regularly, visited her when she could, and their friendship lasted until the day Jackie died. I will always love Carol Channing. During this period, I spent a good deal of my vacation time with my family in Vegas, but I was always happy to get back to New York. I was in my early 30s, I had a great job, I was single, and finally, I had a personal life. From time to time, I would still see Roy Cohn. I knew all his faults, but I could never forget what he had done for my father. We never, ever discussed politics. Though he claimed to be a Democrat, his views were so conservative that had we discussed them, I probably would never have been able to see him again. Instead, I just concentrated on the fact that Roy was very smart and could be very good company. In spite of his despicable role in the McCarthy hearings, he seemed to have a million friends in all walks of life. For all his tough reputation and his questionable favor swapping, Roy had a whole side of life that was legitimate and attractive. He was a close friend of my old friend Bill Sapphire and of William F. Buckley Jr., the founder of the conservative political magazine National Review. Another very good friend was Cy Newhouse, the head of Condé Nast Publishing, and also Cy's parents, Mitzi and Sam, to whom Roy was very loyal. On the political side, he was a friend of President Ronald Reagan, of the Catholic Cardinals, and of the New York political boss, Carmine DiSapio. Roy was like a godfather. You do a favor for me, I do a favor for you. He was also one of the toughest divorce lawyers in New York. On our rare dates, Roy would take me to dinner and then on to the Stork Club, where we would be seated at the best table. Sherman Billingsley, the owner, would sit down with him. So would the leading columnists of the time, Walter Winchell, Leonard Lyons, and Jack O'Brien, who was the most important and toughest television critic of the time. Today, Kate O'Brien, Jack's youngest daughter, is a vice president at ABC News. I've known her since she was a baby. If all these people seem to accept him, I guess I thought I could too. I'm not trying to justify my friendship. I'm trying to make it more understandable. Partly, I suppose, to myself. I really didn't know that Roy was homosexual, though I had heard the rumors about his sexual orientation during the Army-McCarthy hearings. There was no such word then as gay. There wasn't a lot of talk about homosexuality back then. There were obviously plenty of gay people, but their sexuality was never written about in the press or, for that matter, even in private. As I've mentioned, when I saw Roy, the extent of our physical contact was a peck on the cheek. Since he wasn't a real beau, and I didn't want him to be, that suited me fine. I never probed. When I look back, I'm not sure that Roy admitted to himself that he was homosexual until his mother died. I thought his mother was a dreadful woman. Her name was Dora Marcus Cohn, and she came from a prominent German-Jewish family in New York. Roy called her Mutti, a leftover from his childhood, and the German diminutive of Mutter for mother. She doted on Roy's male buddies, but she sure didn't dote on me. She had no idea if and when I saw her son, but she did know of my existence, and she quickly decided I was hardly what she wanted for her beloved son. I was the daughter of a nightclub owner. Roy was the son of a judge. I had no money or social background. Roy had plenty of both. He once brought us together for dinner, and Mutti could barely hide her disdain for me. I wish now that I had told her that I had no interest in her son, but I was raised to be polite and I kept my mouth shut. Be polite, and I kept my mouth shut. My relationship with Mutti improved ever so slightly when I began appearing on the Today Show. She then started treating me with a grudging respect. I still wasn't what she wanted for her son, but people were beginning to talk nicely about me. So when we did occasionally meet at a birthday of Roy's or a special occasion, she would then give me a cool hello. Roy lived with Mutti in an apartment on Park Avenue until she died in 1969. On that day, to my surprise, because I hadn't seen him in a while, Roy phoned me and asked me to come to the apartment to meet with the rabbi. I went. It was the first time I had ever been to his apartment. I could only imagine that it was important to Roy that the rabbi thought he had a girlfriend. From time to time over the years, Roy asked me to marry him. I think he thought he should be married. Plus, he liked children, and he obviously liked me, so why not marry? Of course, I never seriously considered it, but I became Roy's claim to heterosexuality. Whenever a reporter asked Roy why he never married, he always said he had wanted to marry me but was too busy and was married to his work. For one fleeting instant, though, I did think about the possibility. It was when Roy bought a large townhouse. It had four floors, and Roy said my parents and Jackie could have their own apartment on the top floor. The idea of having my parents and sister safe and protected was such an incredible inducement that for one moment I thought maybe. But maybe never became yes. I just couldn't. I knew there was a lot wrong with Roy, and not just sexually. I had witnessed his terrible temper, having heard him scream at people, presumably subordinates, over the telephone. I was appalled. I was also haunted by the lives he had destroyed during the McCarthy era. To many people, among them my friends and colleagues, the memories were still raw. I understood that, but could not explain my relationship with Roy to them. I stopped seeing Roy almost totally during my second year at the Today Show. By then, I had met someone else I'll tell you about later. Over the years, Roy would occasionally call and say, "How are you? Want to have lunch?" We'd then go to one of the fashionable restaurants and catch up on his life. He was never very curious about my life, which was fine with me. His homosexuality became more and more obvious as time went on, but he never admitted it publicly or, for that matter, privately to me. He was, however, becoming quite reckless, and I used to worry that I'd get a phone call in the middle of the night from the police telling me Roy had been murdered by some young trick. As he got older, he had his face lifted several times, and he made no effort to hide that fact. Once, when I saw him for lunch, the stitches were showing. It was a strange and contradictory example of both his vanity and lack of concern for what anyone thought about him. But Roy's quirks didn't seem to hinder him professionally. He still had some very important clients, not to mention all those divorce cases. He bought a yacht, which he kept at the 79th Street Boat Basin in Manhattan. I never visited. He bought a house in Connecticut, where he gave big parties to which I was invited, but also never visited. He must have made a lot of money, but I heard over the years that he never paid his bills. I later learned that he charged everything to his business and constantly owed money to the restaurants and clubs he patronized. And then he got AIDS. In retrospect, it seems inevitable. All the parties on his yacht and in his various houses, all those boys, those endless young one-night stands. Did they rob him, blackmail him? Is that where his money went? Roy never admitted he had AIDS, but the rumors were there. I remember having lunch with him at a very chic restaurant, Le Cirque, and being horrified when he kept sneezing and wiping his nose with a linen napkin. It was so like the thoughtless, selfish Roy who had simply abandoned his car in the middle of the street the first night we'd gone out all those years before. But this might have had much more dangerous consequences. After we left the table, I took the maitre d' aside and told him to throw out the napkin. With everything, though, I remained loyal to Roy, just as all those years ago he had been loyal to me. When in 1986 he asked me to testify on his behalf before the New York Bar Association, which was moving to disbar him for unethical and unprofessional conduct, I did. I knew that Roy was dying, and I asked the committee to spare him so that he could die with some dignity. Roy's close friends, Bill Sapphire and William Buckley, also testified, all of us supposedly in secret, although our testimony leaked to the papers. But the committee had had it with Roy's arrogant and clearly unethical behavior, and they did indeed disbar him. In 2003, Mike Nichols directed the brilliant HBO miniseries Angels in America. It was a devastating, dramatized version of Roy, adapted from Tony Kushner's equally brilliant 1990 play by the same name. In the TV version, Al Pacino played Roy and captured all of his complexities and cruelties. I recognized parts of the portrayal and could not disagree with it, but I could also not dismiss my own memories of Roy. Shortly after he was disbarred, Roy died. It was August 2nd, 1986. He was 59. Passage to India. Jackie Kennedy took a trip to India and Pakistan in March 1962. The White House billed it as a semi-official trip, but officially the administration cleared 45 reporters to cover the First Lady. I was one of them. I was a neophyte among much more senior newscasters from NBC, CBS, and ABC, all male, of course, and veteran print journalists from almost every newspaper and magazine, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Wire Services, Time, the since-defunct Saturday Evening Post, almost all of whom were also male. There were only 7 women assigned to cover Jackie's Goodwill tour, which was actually quite a lot, there being so few women in journalism. 6 of them were print journalists, Fran Lewin for the Associated Press, Marie Ritter for the Ritter newspaper chain, Ann Chamberlain for Time, Gwen Morgan for the Chicago Tribune, Molly Thayer for the Washington Post, and Joan Braden for the Saturday Evening Post. I was the only one from television. How did I get to go? Because Shad Northshield and John Chancellor realized that the story would be perfect for the Today Show audience. A woman's story reported by a woman. Why not send me? I could write and report. I couldn't pack fast enough. I didn't know Jackie Kennedy at the time, but like millions of other Americans, I was dazzled by her fabulous good looks, poise, and style. John F. Kennedy, the young, handsome president, and Jackie, his elegant wife, stood in sharp contrast to their elderly predecessors in the White House, Dwight and Mamie Eisenhower. America was young and vibrant again, and as a result, full of promise and potential. It was an intoxicating time. It was also an exhausting trip. Everything was carefully planned to move the press corps as quickly as possible from one photo op to the next. We all had to lug our baggage and whatever other equipment we had, including our typewriters, which in those pre-laptop days weighed a ton. I should either have taken weight training or been Joan Braden. Joan was a fascinating woman. The mother then of seven, with another yet to come, she was married to Tom Braden, a syndicated columnist who would later write the best-selling book about their family, Eight Is Enough. Joan, with whom I shared a room and later a tent, along with Marie Ritter, was very slim and rather wrinkled from too much sun. She'd supposedly had a fling with Bobby Kennedy, for whom she'd worked on JFK's presidential campaign in 1960, and she was a friend of the whole Kennedy family. She was also an extremely close friend of the famed journalistic brothers Joe and Stuart Alsop. Joe wrote a highly influential syndicated column and was a trusted friend of both President Kennedy and later President Johnson. Stuart was an editor at the Saturday Evening Post, which is how Joan got assigned to Jackie's trip. In years to come, Joan would act as Defense Secretary Robert McNamara's so-called traveling companion after his wife's death. They had an affair, and she went with him all over the world while still married to her husband, who didn't seem to object. It was the topic of conversation for years in Washington. Whatever Joan had should have been bottled and sold to every woman. I tell you all this because every man on the India trip turned out to be mad for Joan. The hard-bitten male reporters fell all over one another, offering to carry her bags, her typewriter, her anything. I was not exactly a dog at the time, but nobody offered to schlep any of my bags. I was my own Sherpa, trundling from place to place. I remember that on that trip, Joan didn't wear stockings, and she got blisters on her heels. The reason I remember this is that some of the guys not only volunteered to carry her bags, they offered to carry her. The amazing thing is that I liked her. Joan was funny, sweet, and very feminine. I did tell you, didn't I, that on that trip, Joan was the married mother of seven children? I learned a few things from her that I never seemed able to put into practice. First of all, she liked to sit on the floor, not on a chair or on a couch. That way she could look up at whatever man she was talking to. She was all eyes and had the ability to look fascinated at will. So there she'd be looking up in awe, while the guy was looking down at his obviously devoted subject. Then, too, she laughed at every joke someone told, and rarely talked about herself. Almost everything she said seemed to come out as a question that would produce an answer. And every conversation, whether with a man or woman, included a compliment. As a result of her social skills and ability to be ingratiating, during the Ford and Nixon administrations, Joan was to become one of the most important hostesses in Washington. She was Henry Kissinger's great friend when he was single and in Washington. She and her husband, Tom, gave a dinner almost every month. Everyone came. The Bradens didn't have a lot of money. After all, they had all those children to support, but nobody cared. Joan kept the lights very low, served spaghetti, and sat on the floor. She was also the only person on the trip to get an exclusive interview with Jacqueline Kennedy. Of course, I myself was hoping to get an interview with the First Lady at some point during the two-week sojourn. The White House had sanctioned all of us. Their various employers, as usual, had paid the White House for our passage. But no. I failed in Rome, our first stop, where Jackie had an audience with the Pope and chatted with him in French. I failed again in India, where she and her sister, Lee Radziwill, escorted by John Kenneth Galbraith, the U.S. ambassador to India, floated around a lake in Udaipur and watched divers plunge into a 50-foot pool at Fedehpur Sikri. My hopes were still high when Jackie visited Gandhi's tomb in Rajghat, rode on an elephant in Amber Village, and lingered in Agra at the spectacular Taj Mahal. But nothing. I pinned my hopes on Pakistan, the last leg of the trip, where the smitten president, Ayub Khan, laid on a horse show for the First Lady, with 2,000 men carrying flaming torches, gave her the Astrakhan hat off his head, and arranged for her and her tag-along press entourage, including me, to traverse the famous Khyber Pass right up to the dangerous border with Afghanistan. But though Jackie left a wake of charm on the president, she did not bestow any on the reporters following her every step. No interview for me then, nor for anybody. She didn't even hold a press conference. I did have one momentous breakthrough in Pakistan when Jackie was visiting a monument. "Mrs. Kennedy, there's a bobby pin falling out of your hair," I said to her. She turned, smiled at me, and said, "Thank you." That was it, my exclusive interview. But I was plenty busy. I had to film a daily segment about the trip for the Today Show and do live radio reports as well. Difficult because there was nothing much to say except where Jackie had been that day and what she was wearing. At one point, she had to take off her shoes to enter a holy temple. We all then excitedly reported that she wore a size 10 shoe. I am sure she could have lived without this rather unappealing piece of information being circulated. But that was already big news for this trip. Things were so slow that the members of the press traded rumors which were impossible to check. A hot one being that Jackie had brought 26 trunks with her as well as 2 maids. Mercifully, I did not report that as fact. It turned out she took only 3 half-filled trunks, leaving room for presents, and 1 maid hairdresser who'd been working for the Kennedys long before they moved into the White House. I was further handicapped by not being included in the small pool of rotating reporters. I didn't even know what a pool was until I went on this trip, and quickly learned that it usually was made up of 1 newspaper reporter, 1 magazine journalist, and 1 broadcast journalist who were allowed closer access to whatever Jackie was doing and then briefed the rest of us. Obviously, if you went with her yourself to any of the events and saw them with your own eyes, you would be able to do a better job of reporting. But I was stiffed by my colleague Sander Van Oker, who was way above me in rank at NBC. He never once let me take his place in the pool, though I was reporting daily on film and radio while Sandy was gathering material for a special broadcast that wasn't going to air for weeks. Would it have killed him to let me once be the broadcast pool reporter? In India, with so little material to work with, I went afield for interviews and scored a big hit for the Today Show when Indira Gandhi, the daughter of Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru, agreed to see me in the Prime Minister's official residence in Delhi. Before I left for India, I had written to Mrs. Gandhi asking for an interview, and while I was there, her people contacted NBC to say she would indeed meet with me. When we got together, she was acting as her father's official hostess and, as such, showed me and my cameraman around the cavernous residence and drove home for me yet again the connection that unites all women: closet space. Her biggest complaint about the mansion was that there weren't enough closets. Also, the kitchen was so far away from the reception room, she said, that any food for guests was cold by the time the servants brought it. So here was a woman who 4 years later would become Prime Minister of India and one of the great world leaders, and she and I had the same complaints. I also didn't much like my kitchen, and in my 3-room apartment, I certainly didn't have enough closets. Strangely, those remarks are what I most remember from that long-ago interview, as they made Mrs. Gandhi very human to me. I was shocked and saddened when she was assassinated in 1984, during her 4th term in office. Let me digress for a minute to tell you of my encounter with one of India's more exotic leaders. His name was Sri Morarji Desai, and he was Prime Minister of India from 1977 to 1979. During that time, I was at ABC trying to work my way back from a disastrous period in my professional life. More about that later. Between December 29, 1977 and January 6, 1978, President Jimmy Carter made whirlwind visits to Poland, France, Belgium, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Iran, and India. I was sent by ABC to cover them and do general reporting. Also assigned were Ted Koppel, then ABC's chief diplomatic correspondent, and Sam Donaldson, our chief White House correspondent. It was love at first sight for me with those guys. We became great buddies, still are, and we spent all our free moments of that trip together. As I had on the Jackie Kennedy trip, I requested in advance the opportunity to interview Prime Minister Desai. He fascinated me because of a regime he publicly proclaimed for his health, which included the imbibing of his own urine for medicinal purposes. The Prime Minister granted my request. He was a thin, ascetic-looking man who answered my questions easily and frankly. After we had discussed Indian and American relations, I asked him about his use of urine as a cure-all. "I do consider urine therapy as a cure for almost all diseases, but the person who does it must have faith in it," he proclaimed. "Urine is a helpful cure for cataracts," he went on. "If you catch them right at the beginning and continue washing your eyes with it." I couldn't wait to send back my report to ABC News. But while I thought I'd gotten astonishing quotes, ABC News thought the whole thing was disgusting and wouldn't run the piece. Let me point out, however smugly, that several weeks later, CBS's Dan Rather also visited New Delhi, interviewed the same Prime Minister Desai, asked the same urine questions, and his network did run the interview. So finally, then, playing catch-up, ABC ran my footage. The network urine wars. But that is not what I want to tell you about. I want to share with you my favorite Ted Koppel, Sam Donaldson anecdote. They were both amused and amazed that I had the nerve to ask such personal questions of Prime Minister Desai. That evening, the three of us went to a restaurant in New Delhi for dinner. We ordered a bottle of white wine. When it arrived, Ted poured a bit of the pale liquid into his wine glass, swirled it around, took a small taste, and gravely pronounced, "It's a good urine. It's not a great urine, but it's a good urine." That was a dinner I will never forget. Back to Jackie and her visit to the ancient pink city of Jaipur, where she had friends, the Maharaja and Maharani of Jaipur. The royal family received Mrs. Kennedy and her party in their enormous city palace, as compared to their several country palaces. It was drop-dead gorgeous, with treasures dating back thousands of years and a more recent towering seven-story temple dedicated to Krishna, one of the most beloved Hindu deities, who was born, tradition says, 5,000 years before Christ. The Today audience was riveted by the wonders of the palace, among which was a large crystal dining room table designed and handcrafted by Lalique, the famed French glassmakers. Just to eat at that table, we all thought, must be thrilling. We were also thrilled to meet the Maharani Gayatri Devi, known to her friends as Aisha. The Maharani was considered one of the world's great beauties, who, for all her over-the-top background, she had been raised in her family's palace with 500 servants, was a respected elected member of India's parliament and founder of several progressive schools. She was also a great hostess and owner of the most exquisite saris, so elegant in her draped silk that I entertained the notion of trading in all my sleeveless wrinkle-proof dresses for silk saris. Perhaps my sari obsession came from delirium because, uncharacteristically, I got really sick over there. I get sick so rarely that once, much later on, when I phoned my grown-up daughter and told her I had a slight temperature, she told me she was coming home immediately to see me, presumably before I died. But I caught a cold sleeping in a tent in Jaipur. There weren't enough hotel rooms for all of us, and I felt so rotten I missed a big ball at the palace. A small world story. At the time of this visit, we met the eldest son and heir of the Maharaja. Years later, in March 2005, I traveled again to India, this time to conduct an interview with His Holiness the Dalai Lama for a special on heaven. After the interview, as a treat, I took my tiny staff for a few days of sightseeing. I hadn't been back to India except for that one brief visit with Ted and Sam. Anyway, one of the high points of our whirlwind tour was a visit to Jaipur. There, our guide told us, he had special contacts and could arrange for us to dine with the current, but now titular, Maharaja. Royalty had gradually lost its power in post-colonial independent India, at the city palace. Another of the royal palaces had been turned into an exquisite hotel, where we were spending the night. For $200 each, our guide promised us a memorable visit back to the glory of old India. How could we resist? $800 later, we arrived at the palace courtyard. There were a few elephants rented for the occasion, with painted foreheads lumbering around. They were obliging creatures, and could also be found at other tourist attractions, where tourists could pay for a ride high atop their backs, which you reached with the help of a small ladder. I did this at one of the temples, but I didn't at the palace, where, along with the elephants, there were a couple of young and very attractive dancers in beautiful bejeweled costumes who whirled and swayed for our benefit. After this brief entertainment, we entered the main salon, where waiting to greet us was an old and obviously very tired gentleman in a blazer and ascot. Lo and behold, he was the same prince and heir I had met all those years ago on the Jackie trip. He was now the Maharaja. I told him we had met before. He certainly remembered Jacqueline Kennedy's visit, but now he had his own heir to worry about, and money was sometimes in short supply. As it turned out, you didn't need special contacts to dine with him. $200 a person would do it no matter whom you knew. For that amount, you could also have dinner in his company at, remember, that wondrous crystal table with its original Lalique designs. I was so touched to meet him again after all those years that I told him he really didn't have to sit through dinner with us. "Do go to bed," I said to him, and he gratefully trotted off. I had another experience on the Jackie trip which I remember for the wrong reasons at the Taj Mahal. I almost missed the private train to our next destination. I can remember the panic I felt 45 years later as I sit here writing this. I was delayed by a phone report I had to make to the office in New York, which left me no recourse but to set off at a dead run for the station. En route, I tripped and badly cut my hand. I had to keep my hand bandaged for weeks. And although I waved it around when I got back to New York so I could say, "I cut it running by the Taj Mahal at sunset," no one ever asked. My last interview of the trip was with Ayub Khan, the president of Pakistan, my first with the head of state, and I can't remember a thing about it. My memory may have been obliterated by my allergy to horses. Jackie's visit to Pakistan, and therefore ours, included a horse show which left me red-eyed and sneezing. Knowing the First Lady's love for horses, Ayub Khan even sent her home with a four-legged gift named Sardar. I turned out to be allergic to camels, too, one of which Jackie rode in Karachi. While the other reporters watched and took pictures, I sneezed. On the last day of the trip, Jackie finally gathered the women reporters and gave us each a little painted box I have to this day. "I know it's been a difficult tour, and I want you to know how much I appreciate it," she said in her breathy voice. That was as close as we came to a press conference. Years later, Jackie and I became sort of friendly and would occasionally have lunch or meet at dinner parties. She was very funny and told me naughty anecdotes about her sisters-in-law, none of which I ever talked about publicly. She said she could never keep up with their athletic pursuits and hated the competitive water skiing, tennis games, and so on. I sympathized. Did I want to interview her? No answer necessary. I tried and tried over the years, requesting an interview with her about her various causes, her favorite books, or the preservation of historical landmarks, for instance. We wouldn't have cared if she just read the yellow pages of the phone book. But she always refused. The truth is, against my own desires, I think she was absolutely right. Her silence kept her mysterious and gave her an aura that she might otherwise have lost. And there would have been so many questions she wouldn't have answered. The only scoop I got on the first India trip, I couldn't use. President Kennedy's philandering is well known now, but at the time, his extracurricular activities were treated as state secrets. The press didn't touch them. I had met the head of the United States Information Agency in India at that time, and he told me, in great secrecy, that as soon as Mrs. Kennedy returned home from India, Angie Dickinson, the actress with whom the president was rumored to be having an affair, was arriving to take exactly the same trip. But though the USIA, members of the State Department, government officials of India and Pakistan, and several members of the press corps, including me, knew about Angie's carbon copy trip, it remained a secret. Try that these days. Since I'd had zero luck getting Jackie to talk, what I could do was invite Joan Braden to appear on the Today Show. She'd gotten the only direct interview with Mrs. Kennedy when Jackie invited her to sit beside her on the plane trip home. This had been prearranged by Stuart Alsop so that Joan could use it for her Saturday Evening Post article. Joan came to New York, where we did a pleasant and not particularly newsworthy interview, but, true to form, she charmed both John Chancellor and Shad Northshield. "Good piece," they both said. Bah humbug. A funeral and a wedding. For all that my first trip to India had been exotic, I was happy to be home. One key reason was that shortly before I'd left, I'd met a man named Lee Goober on a blind date. My friend Joyce Ashley had been going out with him and thought he was terrific, but felt there was no chemistry between them, so she had orchestrated our meeting. "He's nice," she told me, "but you'll never marry him." So I had little expectation when Lee and I met at the Friars Club in New York. Joyce was right. Lee was very nice. That was no surprise. He was also very attractive. Blue eyes, dark hair, very well built. More surprising, we did have chemistry. We went for a long walk that night and talked about our lives. He was divorced with two teenage children. He had recently moved to New York from Philadelphia. That all sounded fine until he told me what he did for a living. He was a theatrical producer. Oh no, not another one. After my experiences with my father, I had sworn to myself that I would never get involved with anyone in show business. It became clear, however, that Lee was quite different from my father. He and two partners had a company called Music Fair Enterprises that owned and operated very successful summer theaters, the Westbury Music Fair in Long Island, and tent theaters in the suburbs around Philadelphia, Boston, Baltimore, and Washington. Lee was the producing partner and staged versions of Broadway musicals like The King and I and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. One of the reasons the tent theaters were so popular was that the stage was round, guaranteeing a good seat to everyone in the house. Another, of course, was that the tent shows brought Broadway to the suburbs as great summer entertainment. Lee also produced Broadway shows, the first of which, The Happiest Girl in the World, had a 3-month run at the Martin Beck Theater in 1961. It was not a major success, but it won a Theater World Award for one of the actors and a Tony nomination for Best Choreography. So, Lee was no slouch. Even so, his Broadway connection made me very anxious. As they say, been there, done that. And not only done it, hadn't liked it. But I really liked him. The only hang-up was his profession. After several months, however, I managed to convince myself that Lee wasn't the same kind of showman as my father. Where my father was a dreamer, Lee was a realist. Where my father was extravagant, Lee was practical. And Lee didn't gamble. He ran his production company like a business. That's what I decided he was, a businessman. Big difference between businessman and producer. So with that reassuring definition in mind, after I got back from India, I began to see Lee seriously. While my personal life was relatively smooth, the Today Show was in turmoil. My reporting from the subcontinent had temporarily boosted Today's viewership, but the audience was declining steadily. The serious, news-oriented slant of the program was obviously not the way most people wanted to greet the day. So within a few months of my return from India, John Chancellor was reassigned to Hard News, and into the anchor's chair went a game show host by the name of Hugh Downs. Hugh was one of the most popular talents at NBC. He had been the charming, unassuming sidekick to the complicated and charismatic late-night talk show host Jack Parr, and had for years also been hosting Concentration, a highly successful quiz show. Hugh was unflappable and perfect for the morning slot, soft-spoken, intelligent, very much the neighbor next door. I liked him immediately. Who could have imagined that I would work with Hugh for the next 9 years at the Today Show, and later for another 15 years at ABC as co-hosts of 2020? I certainly didn't when I, a staff writer, was assigned to write the segment introducing Hugh to the Today Show audience. At first, NBC wasn't too sure they wanted a game show host as their new morning leader. After all, he had no real news experience and, as I was to come to know all too well, network news was a boys' club that didn't welcome newcomers. But Hugh had a gentle way about him and was a serious, thoughtful man who later wrote several books on topics ranging from astronomy to psychological maturity. He also got a master's degree in gerontology. He could certainly conduct a respectful and intelligent interview, so NBC News swallowed their snobbery and hired him. It was the beginning of a most successful, sunny chapter for the network and for me as well. Everything changed. When John Chancellor left, Shad Northshield was out and a new producer, Al Morgan, was in. I got along very well with Al. He had a witty, sardonic sense of humor and had written a best-selling novel called The Great Man, which was a thinly disguised and not overly flattering book about the radio and television star Arthur Godfrey. Shortly after Al took over, he moved the program from Studio 3K in the RCA building across the street into the ground floor offices of the Florida Development Commission. He wanted to restore the interaction with the public that Pat Weaver, the Today Show's creator, had called for way back in 1952. It had worked brilliantly for the 6 years the Today Show spent behind a big glass window on the ground floor of the RCA Exhibition Hall on West 49th Street, dubbed the Window on the World, drawing ever larger, more exuberant, sign-waving crowds in the morning. But the program had been forced to move upstairs inside the RCA building after complaints from a rival TV manufacturer that RCA's products in the exhibition hall could be seen on television. The Florida Development Commission office, however, was hardly an ideal location. During the day, it was decorated with fake palm trees and mannequins wearing shorts, all designed to lure visitors to Florida. By night, all of it, including various cages with minor birds in them, had to be gathered up and stored in a back room so the Today Show set could be ready for early morning. This led to some interesting interactions that Pat Weaver had never envisioned. For Hugh, it meant an early morning review of his material while secreted in a storage room. The mannequins were creepy enough to deal with, but one day, soon after he started, he leaped out of his chair in terror when a voice behind him suddenly said, "My name is Jungle Jim." It was a minor bird, of course. And it was a minor bird that greeted Bobby Kennedy, one of the show's guests in the morning. The storage room was our green room then, and that's where the Attorney General was waiting.
"Who are you?"
came the voice from behind a palm tree. "I'm Robert Kennedy," Kennedy replied.
"Who are you?"
the voice asked again. "I'm Robert Kennedy," the president's brother repeated.
"Who are you?"
the voice persisted, causing Bobby Kennedy to whirl around and snap, "I told you, damn it, I'm Robert Kennedy." And with that, Kennedy stormed onto the set, his face red, his hands shaking, as he sat for his interview. Al Morgan was a very hands-on producer. He watched the show from his home every morning so he could see it as the viewers saw it. Then he'd come into the office and make changes. One of his mandates was that everything had to be live, which was easier in our new location. If we had time to fill, the cameras could pan the crowd outside with their ever-present signs, "Hi, Aunt Tilly," "Happy Birthday, Molly," "Mom, send money." If a guest was late or didn't show up at all, we could take the cameras out into the crowd and interview people. It was called, then and now, Man on the Street. I was supremely happy with my job. For one thing, I loved writing for Hugh. In those days, the writer was also a producer. We contacted the guest, pre-interviewed him or her if possible, wrote the on-camera introduction to the interview, and wrote suggested questions. I never thought there was a possibility I'd get on the air regularly. I understood that an occasional treat like the trip to India was just that, a treat. I had no real substantial on-air experience and no following. I kept in mind the exchange I had when I met Don Hewitt, the celebrated CBS producer who eventually created 60 Minutes. I told him I was working as a writer on Today, and he acknowledged that it was the proper job for me, as I could never make it on the air. "You don't have the right looks," he said, "and besides, you don't pronounce your R's right. Forget about ever being in front of the cameras." Don and I often retell this story, except he adds that he also told a young manager named Marty Ehrlichman to forget about forging a career for his then-young, unknown singer. "She'll never make it," Hewitt told Ehrlichman. "She's funny-looking. Her nose is too big." The singer was Barbara Streisand. Marty Ehrlichman is still her manager. So I continued to write for the show, including scripts for the new tea pourer, Pat Fontaine, a one-time weather girl in St. Louis. She was a very nice woman in her late 30s and the mother of 5 children. There was a flaw, however. She had a drinking problem. Unfortunately, no one found that out until after she'd been hired. Still, she lasted for a year and a half and for the most part was pleasant and professional. But there were mornings when she'd arrive at the studio in no shape to go on the air. One such morning became the beginning of the end. We were broadcasting the show for a week from Mackinac Island off Michigan's Upper Peninsula for no apparent reason other than that the hotel we were staying in had the longest porch in the world and Queen Elizabeth had stayed there once. After being there a few days, we said, "Well, now we know why she never came back." There were so many bats on the island that we were advised to walk in the middle of the street to avoid them as they dived from the buildings. They sometimes got into the hotel, and we quickly learned to gird ourselves with brooms and badminton rackets. One small bat got caught in my toilet, and I nearly fainted. I screamed until Al Morgan and some others rushed in and flushed the bat down the toilet, which upset me even more. No wonder Pat Fontaine drank herself silly one night. But sadly for her, she chose the wrong night. We had to leave the hotel by 4:30 a.m. to broadcast the show live from a place that could be reached only by ferry. The show was going to be a big deal for Michigan tourism. The governor was coming, as well as various other state officials, including the director of tourism and a jovial priest we called Father Chuck. There were about 100 people gathered in the hotel lobby at 4:15, but not Pat Fontaine. Al dispatched a crew member to her room who quickly reappeared to report that Pat was passed out in bed. "I couldn't wake her up," he announced. So Al sent 2 women to haul poor Pat into the shower, pour coffee into her, and dress her, all in 20 minutes. Her wobbly appearance at the top of the stairs did not inspire our confidence, but it did inspire her to break into a grin when she saw the priest below. "Father Chuck, you are one swinging mother priest," bellowed Pat to her drinking companion of the night before. Pat managed to get through the program. Father Chuck was very quiet on the ferry. In spite of my limited on-air experiences, to my joy, when we got back from the Bat Capital, Al assigned me to broadcast features at least once every few weeks, and slowly, slowly, I honed the skills that would sustain me in this business from then on. I learned to speak more slowly and to smile more. I was far too intense during interviews. I had to learn to lighten up on camera, which I eventually managed to do. All the stories I did then were about women, reporting on the rise of political conservatism at several women's colleges, reporting from a reform school for young women in Michigan and from a school for police women in New York. I can still do the bunny dip from an insider report I did as a bunny at the Playboy Club in New York, a night in the life of a Playboy bunny. I was not very recognizable, and the customers thought I was a real waitress. We used only one hidden camera to record my stint as a rabbit. The other bunnies and I wore the same uncomfortable but flattering costume, a tight-in-the-waist sort of corslet that pushed up the almost exposed bosom, black stockings, and very high black heels. The sexy effect, depending on how you looked at it, was either enhanced or diminished by the bunny ears and bunny tails we also had to wear, but the trick was to master the bunny dip while serving drinks without dipping your boobs into the wine glasses. Here's how you do it. Keeping your legs together, slightly bend your knees and shift a bit to the right while leaning slightly backward. The squared-off position protected your cleavage, but it was murder on the thighs. I didn't really enjoy doing that story, which took 2 days of filming. But I can still do the bunny dip. Hugh Down said it was the first time he knew I had legs. I learned a more sobering lesson at a Catholic convent just outside New York. The nuns invited me inside their peaceful, quiet world so that viewers would understand that giving up a secular life did not make them freaks. A young novitiate was assigned to show me around, and to my discomfort, she began to talk to me about the deep conflict she was feeling. The poor young woman was so desperate that when she drove me to the train station at the end of the day, she suddenly turned to me and asked, "Do you think I should stay here and become a nun?" I didn't know what to say. Clearly she was looking for someone to make the decision for her, but clearly I didn't want that person to be me. I think she was extremely disappointed when I told her the answer to her question required a lot more wisdom than I possessed, but that I was sure she would find her own way. On the train back to New York, I could still see her troubled young face and felt that somehow I had let her down. That was one of the first times I truly began to understand the power of television. Because people saw me and others on their TV screens, they automatically assumed we must have some sort of special wisdom. Otherwise, we wouldn't be on the air. Television not only validated our opinions, it made us all-knowing. The truth is that while we may be more articulate, we may be just as confused about things as the people watching at home. Television imbues us with an authority that often makes me uncomfortable. On a political panel much later, I told the audience, "Please remember, just because we're on television, we are not gods." That prompted John Chancellor to say with a smile, "Speak for yourself, Barbara." By the way, the novitiate wrote me a few weeks after our encounter to say she had left the order. I felt terrible and tried desperately to remember what, if anything, I'd said to her that may have influenced her decision. I felt so responsible for her life, while I was having difficulty figuring out my own. Lee and I got engaged in the summer of 63. All the old terrors about marriage returned, but this time I was determined to overcome them. What I wanted more than anything was to have a baby, and I knew Lee would make a great father, having seen his close relationship with his two children, Carol, who was then 17, and Zev, 16. I became especially close to Carol, who was in that awkward adolescent stage. Today she is an accomplished nutritionist who wrote a highly acclaimed book in 2002 on controlling diabetes. She has diabetes herself, and we are still in touch. I signed my emails to her, the wicked stepmother, which I called myself from the earliest days of our relationship. Obviously, she doesn't agree. At least I hope not. Lee's children were a bonus in the relationship and in no way a detriment. Then, too, there was the stability, that word again, that I envisioned marriage would bring. My parents were changing their lives again, through no fault of their own. The owners of the Tropicana in Las Vegas had decided they didn't need my father anymore. The Folies Bergère he'd brought from Paris were firmly established, and the hotel executives decided they could produce the show themselves. So they let him go. It would have been nice if my parents and Jackie could have stayed in Las Vegas, where they had established a good life. My father was almost 70. He should have been able to retire, but he didn't have enough money. So he accepted a job producing shows at the Carillon, a popular modern high-rise hotel in Miami Beach, and moved my mother and sister back to Florida. I began to dread the sound of the phone, anticipating my mother's unhappy words. But, though I hated the litany, her complaints were valid. Without consulting her, my father had gone off and bought a house way outside the city. My mother didn't drive. She had no friends. She and Jackie were stuck there, left to spend the whole day in front of the television set. It was on one of my trips to that cheerless house in the summer of 63 that my father came up with yet another grandiose scheme, an aquacade. The last successful aquacade had been almost 25 years before at the 1939 World's Fair, a musical extravaganza in a huge swimming pool with fantastic synchronized divers, a water ballet, and fireworks. Others had since tried, and failed, to mount similarly successful water shows. This did not discourage my always optimistic father. "A show is a show," he told me. "You give the people something spectacular, and they'll come." There we were, again. My father, and a new dream, but no money. And there I was, with his dream and $5,000 in savings in the bank, $5,000 he wanted me to invest. As Yogi Berra would say, it was deja vu all over again. I didn't know what to do. So I turned to Lee. We had dinner with my father in Florida. Lee listened carefully while my father raved on about his plans, a Latin Quarter revue in the water with pretty girls, lavish costumes, music, color, excitement, the best water show ever in America. "What would you do if you had only $5,000 to your name?" Lee asked him. "I'd invest it in the aquacade," my father replied. Well, that was no surprise to me, but it seemed to satisfy Lee. "Give your father the money," he said. I was still clinging to my definition of Lee as a businessman, so I did as he suggested and handed over my savings to my father. What I refused to acknowledge was that my father and Lee were more alike than they were different. Both of them lived for the next show. Their attitude was, and I suppose had to be, "This time surely it will be a hit." They felt it. They knew it. All they needed was the money to produce it. The aquacade flopped. It didn't create a ripple. My $5,000 was gone, as was all the money my father had scraped together to invest in his new dream. But with it all, in retrospect, I'm glad I loaned him the money. I wouldn't have been able to forgive myself if I hadn't let him try. And I was working. I could start to save money again. I also didn't blame Lee. Many people had been seduced by my father's dreams. Some of those dreams had paid off spectacularly, just not this one. But I was becoming increasingly uneasy about our engagement. It had nothing to do with Lee and the aquacade. It was about my own dream that somewhere out there was the perfect man whom I would deeply love. That person just wasn't Lee. Although he was indeed handsome and kind, and I couldn't find any real faults, somehow it wasn't enough. Once more I felt hemmed in. So at the end of the summer of 1963, I broke our engagement. Here we go again. Naturally, I wasn't at all sure I'd made the right decision. There were days when I missed Lee, and days when I didn't miss him at all. I didn't think we'd be happy together, but I knew I wasn't happy without him. Then came Friday, November 22nd, 1963, the day no one who was alive at that time will ever forget. I was eating lunch in the little office at NBC that I shared with another writer, Bob Cunniff, when Hugh Downs suddenly burst in. "Have you heard?" he said. "There's a report that President Kennedy has been shot." The next report confirmed his death. Within hours, the breaking news was of the arrest in Dallas of Lee Harvey Oswald, an ex-Marine, for allegedly killing the president. Television came of age that dark day. All entertainment programming was canceled, and for the next 4 days, NBC and the other networks carried live saturation coverage of the national tragedy. During what became known as Black Weekend, television turned from being the boob tube, as it was sometimes known, to a cohesive national gathering place for a shocked nation. NBC needed every able body it had to cover the young president's state funeral, beginning on Sunday, November 24th, 2 days after the assassination. So I became an on-air reporter. I was assigned to a position outside the Capitol to cover the arrival of the horse-drawn caisson carrying the president's coffin from the White House. There was profound silence all along Pennsylvania Avenue that day, broken only by the muffled roll of funereal drums and the clip-clop of the horse's hooves pulling the caisson. Hugh Downs was anchoring the Today Show from an NBC studio in Washington, and he had to coordinate and comment on every report that came in from the various reporters in the field. He also had to deal with the surreal pictures coming in from Dallas, which only NBC captured live, of Oswald being shot to death in the basement of the police station by a local nightclub owner, Jack Ruby. As the footage of the murder was played over and over again, interspersed with live images of the funeral cortege, Nielsen, the television rating service, estimated that 93% of all television sets in the nation were tuned into the coverage. 93%. There hasn't been anything like that since. I remained at the Capitol, where President Kennedy was lying in state in the rotunda. My job was to report on both the dignitaries and the long lines of everyday people arriving to pay their last respects. I found an old film clip from that day. I'm wearing a black coat, I have long dark hair, and I'm saying, "These are the honor guards who have been guarding the casket of President Kennedy. If I feel or seem a bit choked up, it is because I have just left the last guard." This was the first time I'd reported a national news event. But aside from that small piece of film, which brings back a moment of the event to me, I went through the day and the night in a fog. I was at the Capitol, it seems, for at least 8 hours. More than 250,000 people filed past the casket, and the viewing hours had to be extended late into the night and the early morning. Eventually, we moved inside the rotunda, where we reported live from 2 a.m. to 4 a.m. The lines of people paying tribute to the president seemed never to end. When we went off the air and other correspondents took over, Hugh and I went back to our hotel, completely wiped out physically and emotionally. The next day, I returned to New York and watched the rest of the funeral on television. The caisson carrying the president's coffin from the White House to St. Matthew's Cathedral, followed on foot by Mrs. Kennedy, flanked by Robert and Edward Kennedy. The images remain indelible. Little John John Kennedy turned 3 that very day, saluting his father's coffin from outside the cathedral. The expressions of such wrenching sorrow on the faces of the Kennedys that you wanted to turn away. Like everyone else from coast to coast, I shared the same state of depression and shock. One single sunny day in Texas, one deranged man, and suddenly Kennedy was gone, his assailant murdered, and his vice president Lyndon Johnson, the new president. A few days later, I was in my apartment washing my hair when the doorbell rang. I went to the door with a towel wrapped around my head, and there was Lee. "Life is too short," he said, while water dripped from my head to the floor. "Let's get married right now." I understood completely. What did it matter that we hadn't talked for the 3 months since I'd broken the engagement? Every doubt I'd had, every reservation about this or that, now seemed so petty compared to the glimpse into the brevity of life we had all just experienced. I can only imagine how many women got pregnant during those few days, or how many couples decided not to divorce or got married. I was one of them. "Yes," I told Lee, "let's get married." The whole thing happened so quickly this time I didn't have time to get cold feet. My father flew up from Florida while my mother stayed behind with Jackie. Marilyn Landsberger, my wonderful friend who had welcomed me into her home after my first marriage broke up and was now married to a very nice man named Seymour Herskovitz, offered their apartment for the wedding. And on December 8, 1963, just 2 weeks after the Kennedy assassination, I became Mrs. Lee Goober. 13 weeks to 13 years. It probably won't surprise you by this point, but the marriage did not get off to a great start, at least my half of it. We hadn't had the time to plan a honeymoon, so one of Lee's friends lent us his small house in East Hampton for a week. But it was winter, and freezing, much too cold to walk on the beach, or anywhere for that matter. East Hampton today is a very popular summer resort on Long Island, and many people go there all year round on weekends. But back in the 60s, it was mostly home to self-sufficient writers and artists, and just about every restaurant was closed for the off-season. The one movie theater in town ran the same feature every night. Television had barely come to East Hampton. There was just one fuzzy channel out of Connecticut. Lee was very sweet and cooked delicious meals. He was a gourmet cook. But all my old demons surfaced. He was a kind man, and I loved him. But I wasn't passionately in love with him. Again, and this won't be a shock either, I felt trapped and restless. Perhaps I just wasn't cut out for marriage. I remember when Lee produced our marriage license and told me he had to mail it to state officials for everything to be legal. I had an immediate urge to grab it, tear it up, and tell him to forget the whole thing. If I was bad at marriage, I was even worse at skiing. It was almost Christmas, and Lee had promised Carol and Zev that he would take them to Stowe, Vermont for vacation. Therefore, our more or less official honeymoon took place 2 weeks later in that well-known ski resort. As I've said, I liked his children, and it was a chance for the four of us to bond as a new family. Once at Stowe, Lee and his kids whizzed down the taller mountain, while I took lessons on the beginner's hill. I was miserable. My ski boots hurt my ankles. I was chilled to the bone in spite of my new and fashionable parka and ski pants. I couldn't figure out how to handle my poles, let alone the skis themselves. I saw little kids taking off and moving up to the next class, while I was still plodding along trying to navigate up and down a baby slope. When my first hour lesson was finally over, I limped off to the lodge, took off the damn boots, and sat by the fire in tears. I tried again the next day, but then, while standing stock still, I lost my balance and fell over. What a klutz! It did not help that there was a sign on the ski school blackboard reading, "Welcome Today Show's Barbara Walters." It somehow made me feel even more inadequate. Sure, I could talk, but I obviously couldn't do anything else. I went back to the lodge for good. By the way, since my decision to give up skiing, I've always had a wonderful time at ski resorts. Après-ski is my favorite sport.